Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 124 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Sobalski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. So today I thought we would do something fun and look at some of the wacky theories that medieval people had about the world. I spend most of my time and I've spent most of my career kind of rehabilitating the Middle Ages from the ideas that people have of it being superstitious, that people had no thoughts of their own and the thoughts that they did have were a little bit bananas by our standards. But I thought today we would dive into some of the stuff that was actually pretty wacky. And I think that maybe looking around today, we can have a bit of compassion for some of the strange theories of the Middle Ages, because there are certainly a lot of strange theories about the world that are swirling around the internet right now. If we just take even the smallest dive into the internet, we can see there's a lot of wackiness out there today as well. So before I start with some of these wacky theories, and they're all over the place, I just picked a miscellany because why not? It's my podcast, right? I can do what I like. So before we dive into it, I really want to make sure that people know that even if something is written down in the Middle Ages, it's not necessarily representative of what everybody thinks. So this was not a time where you could ride around and take a poll of what people thought and write that down in your book with statistical information. It was a time where people were gathering as much information as they could. They were talking to friends, they were talking to authorities, they were reading stuff that had been written down before, especially the Greeks and Romans. And all of this informed what they thought about the world. So it's very individual in a lot of ways when you read something from the Middle Ages about their perspective on the world. Sometimes it's something that has been gathered or gleaned from discussion or from study, but often it can just be an idea that one person had. So when we look at the Middle Ages and we look at one source, and remember that we don't have all that many sources in relative terms. When we look at a source, we need to think of it as being somewhat individual in many cases and not kind of extrapolate from that to suggest that everybody in the Middle Ages thought the same thing, especially if it's something that is a little wacky. So it might help to think about it as looking on a friend's Facebook and you figure most of what they're saying, they probably gathered from information that they read or heard, but also it's interpreted through their own lens. So when we look at sources from the Middle Ages, we do have to bear in mind that there was an individual writing this down, and in many cases, it is flavored by that individual's thoughts and feelings. So just wanted to get that out of the way and mention that to you. Don't forget about the human element when we talk about these wacky theories. So the first one I wanted to talk about was one that might seem familiar to us today, and that is there were human reasons for the Black Death. And of course, the Black Death is not something that's funny in any way, but some of the reasons that people thought the Black Death might have occurred are a little bit funny. And one that really jumped out at me that I remember from when I spoke to David Green about the Hundred Years' War right at the beginning of my podcast journey. I mean, go back and listen to that because David Green is the best, but my sound is terrible because I was just learning what I was doing. But David Green's book on the Hundred Years' War is fabulous. And there was one little nugget of information that I thought was really interesting. And that was that there is a chronicler named John of Reading who attributed the Black Death to the fact that people were wearing fashions that made it so that they couldn't actually pray. So he said that there in the 14th century, people were wearing hose that was so tight that they could not kneel down to pray. And that was one of the reasons that the Black Death had hit Europe. No one was praying because they were too fashionable and their hose were too tight. They couldn't even bend their knees to pray. Now, in the 14th century, there are a lot of preachers that are down on people's fashion. The 14th century is when people were wearing really long, pointy shoes. Women were starting to wear their hair in all sorts of elaborate styles, and they were wiring it into cones like those devil horns. They were plucking eyebrows and their hairlines as well, leading into the 15th century too. So fashion was something that was really going on in the 14th century, and fashion was apparently one of the reasons that the Black Death hit, because everyone was wearing hose that were too tight. Now, again, this is not what everybody thought. And this is probably not what the chronicler even really thought himself, but it was related to the fact that the Black Death was blamed on immorality. And one of the ways that you could be immoral or sinful was to be vain. And vanity was definitely showed off by fashion. There's lots of other sermons in the 14th century that talk about women who perhaps pluck their eyebrows and then afterwards, when they go to hell for their vanity, are being stabbed by needles, by demons, that kind of thing. So when it comes to the Black Death, one of the theories, at least from one chronicler, is that it was caused by people wearing their hose too tight. Another theory that's kind of hilarious that I talked about with Eleanor Yanaga only a few weeks ago, earlier in the summer, is we talked about the wandering womb syndrome. And that was basically thinking of the uterus as being something that could be anywhere in the body at any time and causing trouble to women. So you can go back and listen to that episode. But the long and the short of it is you need to pin the womb down by pregnancy. Pregnancy is the best way to do it. It keeps it right where it's supposed to go. Otherwise, you might have to do things like fumigate the vagina to bring the uterus back into place, because it could be, like I said, anywhere in the body causing trouble. So wandering womb is definitely something to look into if you like medieval wacky theories. We can't really blame this one on the Middle Ages, because this is one that goes back to the ancient Greeks and Romans. So there are a lot of wacky theories about the world that go back to the ancient Greeks and Romans, but the Middle Ages gets the blame for it. Wandering womb is one of those things. Another wacky theory that I think was kind of hilarious is one that can be found in Bald's Leech book. So this is a book that became famous about 6 or 7 years ago because there is a remedy in it for an eye infection, for a sty, that was recreated by a couple of universities, and it was found to kill a superbug called MRSA. Now, this is controversial because with any sort of medieval recipe, you do have to do some interpretation to figure out how much you need, what exactly they're talking about, and how long you prepare it for, all of those things. If you've ever looked at an actual recipe, like a cookbook from the Middle Ages, you'll know that it's very vague and random. So I do think it's encouraging that they've reproduced this recipe and it could fight a superbug, and I think that's great. I think anytime we can do something that is imaginative and that works to fight disease, I think is a great thing. But whether it's this recipe in Bald's Leech book that is a cure that we can use or not, that's not the wacky one that I'm talking about. But this is why Bald's Leech book is famous. It was written in the 900s, and it has all sorts of cures in it. It's called the Leech book because it's named for the Anglo-Saxon word for doctor, which was leech. And there are a lot of really cool recipes in it. There are ones that help you fight elves and demons, but one that I think is especially random, and I mentioned this in my TED talk because I thought this was so random, was if someone is having an episode where they are insane, they are dealing with madness, what Bald's Leech book suggests is that you are meant to kill a porpoise and create a whip out of the porpoise's skin and proceed to whip the person who is having this episode and they will feel better. Now, there are lots of cures for madness or other mental health episodes in the Middle Ages that are not always very kind. There's often a lot of restraint involved, or people who are put in a place where they cannot hurt other people while they are having an episode. Fortunately, this is one of the only ones I've come across where there is meant to be an actual physical altercation with that person. I don't know why it's a porpoise skin, and this is one of the things I find most curious about it. Fortunately, not only is it difficult to find a porpoise, but also people in the Middle Ages had more compassion than we give them credit for. So I don't think that this is a quote-unquote cure that people would be using very often in the Middle Ages, but it is just so random that I thought this would be one to mention in terms of wacky theories that people had in the Middle Ages. Now, one of the ones that I've heard quite a lot in reading about medicine, about the Middle Ages, in books that are written now, they mention that people used St. John's wort to cure demonic possession or to cure depression in the Middle Ages. So I dug into this a little bit because I wanted to find out if it was true. And unfortunately, it doesn't seem to be true. So in the centuries after the Middle Ages, people did use St. John's wort to help treat depression. And it seems from some of the studies that have been done today that it could actually work. Using St. John's wort could help to cure depression. It has also been used to help people who are having severe PMS, which I think you could relate to demonic possession if you're being particularly sarcastic, but that would be unkind to do. In the Middle Ages, St. John's wort was used as a way of getting rid of demons, yes, but it wasn't used as a treatment that you would ingest. It was used as something that you would put around a room to keep the demons out. It was used in combination with other things, but it wasn't used as a treatment by itself, from what we can tell. So St. John's wort is a really interesting herb. It's been used for thousands of years, but it doesn't seem to have been used for a melancholy, which is something that people would have recognized in the Middle Ages, even if it's used for melancholy or depression now. So again, I'm not a doctor. I'm not going to tell you to use St. John's wort, but I do find it really interesting when we see herbal remedies that are related to ones that could have been used back in the day. Now, again, St. John's wort was used to get rid of demons, but not ones that were inside the body. At least you weren't meant to take St. John's wort as an oral remedy when it came to dealing with mental health episodes in the Middle Ages. Before we leave medicine behind, one of the wackiest treatments that people attribute to the Middle Ages as being completely useless and not efficacious at all is bloodletting. And again, this is something that you can't attribute to the Middle Ages by itself. This is something that is an ancient cure that was used to make sure that you have a balance of the humors. Now, I'm not going to get into the humors too much right now. I do want to mention that I did talk about medieval medicine on a few podcasts in the past, and one of them was with Dr. Joe Alcock, who is a friend of mine and an emergency room physician, and he does mention that perhaps there could be something to bloodletting. So let's not let that one be dismissed as completely wacky until we have thought about it a little bit more with our modern scientific method and methods of study. And since I've mentioned the scientific method, let me also mention the fact that even if people didn't follow a scientific method in the same terms that we use today, the ones I had to write down in grade six with a purpose and a hypothesis and the apparatus and all of those things, people were experimenting in the Middle Ages. They were extremely smart when it came to remedies, especially herbal remedies or medical ones. So I never want to dismiss medieval medicine as being useless. I just figured today we could talk about some of the remedies that were perhaps a little odd. So moving on to another section of medieval life that I think is really interesting is bestiaries or bestiaries. I never know how to pronounce this, so I'm going to go with bestiaries because that's what I hear most often. It's one of those things where you read a word so often and you never know quite how to pronounce it so that you sound smart. So let's all pretend that I'm sounding smart when I say bestiary. One of the ones that I find really interesting is the one about bears. And Latin word for bear is ursus. And the bestiary, at least the one that I look at a translation by T.H. White that's quite old, but it's got a lot of good footnotes. If you find it in a used bookstore, pick that one up. It mentions that ursus is related to orsus, which is related to aura, which is the word mouth, or it has to do with mouths. And they mention in the bestiary that bears are named this because they use their mouths to sculpt their cubs. I think this is a really fascinating one. All sorts of descriptions of animals in bestiaries are hugely fascinating to me. The one about bears and their cubs is very interesting. It says that bears always deliver their cubs early so that they are born as a formless mass. And then bears will lick the cubs into shape, forming their limbs with their mouths, with their tongues. This is really interesting to me because when you see an animal deliver, of course, the first thing it does is clean off its offspring. And this is really cool because you would actually see a bear clean off its offspring. Now, that said, you would also see all sorts of other animals clean off their offspring, but there is a real effort in bestiaries to pull together the Latin word for an animal and explain how that is how they got their name, that it's essential to their character. Another one, of course, it's my favorite, is castor, which is the word for beaver. and you'll see this in my book too, because I just love it, where a beaver recognizes that hunters are after him for his oils. So in order to escape the hunters, he will chew off his own testicles and throw them at the hunters to give them the castor oil. And of course, that means it's related to the word castration, which is why a beaver has the name castor. Which of course is completely bogus, but I love it. It's a great story. So coming back to bears for a minute, the effort that the mother bear makes in creating its offspring, shaping it with her mouth, leaves her so exhausted that she sleeps for 3 months and nothing can wake her up until afterwards. So this is another way of explaining away bears' hibernation, which I think is really fascinating. There are a couple of other details about bears which are really fascinating. One is that they mate like humans, so not in the way of other animals, but face-to-face like humans, and that when a mother bear is pregnant and it's time for her to give birth, the father bear gives her privacy, so she has basically her own room and her own bed in her den to give birth. Now, again, this is one of these things where obviously the bestiary is written by someone who's never actually crawled into a bear's den and watched her give birth. So you have to take it with this sort of grain of salt, where you have someone who's extrapolating from all sorts of things, the Latin name for the bear and its habits, the things that have been observed about it in the natural world, and bringing all these things together to explain to people what a bear is, what it's called, and how it got that name. And of course, I think all of these explanations are super fascinating. If you get the chance to look at a bestiary online, there are lots of ones that are scanned, and you can actually see the pictures that people have drawn of the animals. And most of the people who have drawn these animals are scribes, many of them monks, if you're looking at an earlier version of it, who have never seen things like a leopard in their own lives. They've never seen a lion. They don't know what they look like. And you can see their best efforts at drawing them. So all of the stories in the bestiaries are some of my favorites. There's usually a moral to the story about most animals that will tell you a little bit more about why they are called what they're called and what they mean to good Christians. The version of the bestiary that I have doesn't mention any specific moral attributes of the bear, but it does note a bunch of things like you can't keep bears away from honey. They love it. They also love to eat ants and mandrakes too. I love the bestiary. It is something that you should check out if you can, if you have a moment. Some of the wackiest medieval theories are found in there, but they're also, you can see the ways that they have been created in a combination of creative thinking, making connections, and also allegorical thinking as well. Now, the last wacky medieval theory that I want to bring up is the trial by ordeal, that is the trial by water. So this is something that is misunderstood in a whole lot of ways. So the way that you hear it most often is witch trials in the Middle Ages, where the witch is bound and they're thrown in a lake, and if they drown, they're innocent, and if they swim, they are guilty. So let's take this apart, because that's wrong in a whole bunch of ways. First of all, witch trials were mainly performed in the early modern period. So there are very few witch trials that occurred in the Middle Ages. There were trials for heresy, and you weren't tried for heresy the first time you said something that wasn't correct. You were corrected by the priest, you were asked to repent, you were asked to do some penance, and you were usually fine. Most people were not actually tried for heresy. They were given penance and they were let off and everything was fine. So first of all, there's not a lot of trials for heresy in the grand scheme of things. It didn't happen all that much. Secondly, trial by ordeal was something that was done for heresy in the early Middle Ages. It wasn't something that was done in the later Middle Ages for reasons that I will get to in a second. When somebody went through the trial by water, what was done was a pit was specially dug for it. You didn't usually throw somebody in a lake. A pit was dug for it. It was filled with water and it was blessed by a priest. Now, this is an important part of the whole thing, because it doesn't work if it's not blessed by a priest. Because when a priest blesses this body of water, it becomes holy water. So it's not just any water. They're not just tossing people in a lake, because The theory was that if the holy water accepted the person who was thrown in it, that means that that person was a good Christian and the water accepted them, embraced them as a good Christian. If the holy water rejected the person, then they were guilty because obviously they weren't holy, that they weren't accepted by God. So it's not as simple as, you know, this idea that someone would drown if they were innocent and they'd float if they were guilty. It was all about the holiness of the water and whether it would accept the person who was put in it. So we're misunderstanding it if we think that people just didn't understand how swimming worked, because they did understand how swimming worked. We do have manuscript images of people swimming, so I mean, they did understand that. So trial by ordeal was something that was done in the early part of the Middle Ages, and it was actually not really well liked for a lot of reasons. One of them being that, theologically speaking, you shouldn't be testing God and you shouldn't be making him do things by, you know, just asking him to come down off of his heavenly throne and to preside over a trial. That's cheeky. You shouldn't be asking God to do that. So that's one thing. And the other thing is, most of these ordeals, whether it's water, it's fire, it's combat, they could be circumvented by cleverness, right? So if you had somebody who was thrown in the water and they actually knew how to swim, or they had made it so that they weren't wearing all that many clothes, they weren't weighed down, they could keep themselves above the water just enough where they could hold their breath long enough, that could make it so that the trial was not accurate. It wasn't following God's will. If you had a trial by ordeal where someone was holding something hot, they burned themselves. If that person's hand was wrapped in a salve that would help with the healing, then obviously that would circumvent God's will there as well. If you had trial by combat where somebody asked to have a champion in their place and the champion was obviously a better fighter than the person on the opposite side, again, God's will could be circumvented in that way. So people were not stupid. They didn't believe that things turned out always the way they quote unquote should during these ordeals. So for that very reason, trial by ordeal was actually banned by Innocent III in 1215. So he made it so that priests could not be involved in trial by ordeal. So you couldn't actually have an official trial by water without a priest, because then the water wouldn't be holy water. So this was done a lot less than people imagine, because even the Pope said, well, all right, this doesn't actually work very well. So when we have people talking about medieval witch trials where people were thrown in a lake and they drowned because they were innocent, it's really misunderstanding a whole bunch of things. Now, this is not to say that the idea of throwing someone in water to judge their innocence is not perhaps a little bit wacky to begin with. Well, fair enough, it's kind of a wacky theory to begin with, but we should understand it before we get on our high horses about how things are different now. And finally, it doesn't seem like it would be a good episode on wacky medieval theories if I didn't mention the flat earth thing. As far as we know from pretty much everything we've read of the Middle Ages, nobody thought the earth was flat. Everyone thought it was a sphere. You can see this over and over and over and over and over again in the way they describe the earth and the way they draw the earth. I mean, they were incorrect about a bunch of things, like the fact that Jerusalem is the center of the universe and that everything revolved around earth. That, again, is not necessarily all their fault, because there was precedent in ancient Greece, but it was also based on theological ideas, and that made the most sense when it came to ideas about God and the universe and man's place in the universe. But they did know it was a sphere, because otherwise astrology, astronomy, and all of those mathematical things like navigation wouldn't actually work. So in case you haven't come across my work before where I mention this a lot, nobody thought that the earth was flat back in the day, even though a whole bunch of people think that the earth is flat today. So in conclusion, the things I want you to take away from this episode are that people did have some wacky ideas in the Middle Ages. Not all of them were nice. Not all of them were going to work. They were pretty strange theories in a lot of cases. And I do think that they're fun to sometimes visit and think about how people came to these conclusions, what informed them, what informed this worldview. And again, it's worth mentioning that not everybody thought all the same things all the time. That's really worth reiterating because I think every time I see an article written by a non-specialist about the Middle Ages, they do mention that people were kind of drones that only thought one thing all the time. So these were theories that not everybody held. And again, they're individualistic in a lot of ways. And while I am somebody who really advocates for looking back to history when it comes to learning about human nature and how people dealt with stuff, what they cared about, what they felt, all of these things I think are super important when it comes to looking at humans. It is really important to remember that we have come a long way since the Middle Ages when it comes to our understanding of the world, the natural world, and medicine and all of those things. So in this time where people are suspicious of experts, perhaps, it's worth remembering that we have come a long way, that we can trust our scientists. They do have our best interests at heart, and they will tell us a lot more about bears, perhaps, than we might have learned from a medieval bestiary. And speaking of experts that you can trust, I do want to steer you in the direction of medieval experts that talk about a lot of the things that I mentioned today. So when it comes to wandering wombs, definitely check out the podcast with Eleanor Yanaga. You can also look at the Trotula with Monica Green, who is also on the podcast. When it comes to medieval medicine, Monica is always amazing, as well as Winston Black, who has been on the podcast a couple of times. And when it comes to medieval science in general, especially when it comes to physics, definitely look at Seb Falk's work as well. So all of these guys are experts that you can hear on the podcast, and I definitely encourage you to look up their other work because they will tell you everything you need to know about the theories that were both wacky and sound in the Middle Ages. Before we go, here's Peter from medievalist.net to tell us what's on the website. What's going on, Peter?
Hey, hey. Well, we have a new podcast on medievalist.net. It's called Bow and Blade, and it's hosted by Kelly DeVries and Michael Livingston. You've had them on the show before?
Yes.
They're pretty good. They're pretty funny. Talking about medieval military history, all types of warfare. So we're really glad to have them. And it's like the fifth podcast we have on, like, on the medievalist.net network, right? So,
Yeah, it sounds like you're building a network. Yeah.
Building an empire. So that now is out. Its first episode is on the Battle of Hastings. Start off small.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Michael and Kelly never start off small. They always take on big, big projects, and especially ones where they get to dig right in. So I think it's going to be a fun podcast. But speaking of fun podcasts, we have you said five. So let's count them out. Well, there's the Medieval Podcast, which is, yeah, of course, the best one. I just got to say that.
Indeed. The very best. We have Byzantium and Friends.
Yeah, with Anthony Caldelis, who's great.
Yeah, Scottish Chronicast.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
All Things Scotland. The Medieval Grad Podcast.
Yes.
That's our other new podcast.
Yeah, just started this summer.
Yeah, I really enjoy that. And then now, yeah, Bow and Blade.
Yeah, so if you love the medieval world, people, there are all sorts of medieval podcasts coming out now. But of course, stick with this one because, well, it's the best one, right?
Very true. You're a flagship show.
There's something to be said for being here first, right? And I can say I'm the best one. All right, thanks, Peter. We'll look forward to listening to all of these podcasts. Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Thank you, as always, to our patrons on patreon.com for all your support. Patrons of the Medieval Podcast can choose from all sorts of amazing stuff, like subscriptions to Medieval Warfare Magazine and the Medieval Magazine, membership in our book club, and our exclusive maps by Tina Ross. To find out how to become a patron of the Medieval Podcast, please visit patreon.com/medievalists. And it's last call for this session of the Medieval Masterclass for Creators. This is a 6-week online course that I put together with some amazing experts to help people creating medieval fiction get all those little details that they need without having to spend hours lost on the internet. We cover everything from cooking to combat, blacksmithing and textile work, and we do it all with video demonstrations, helpful bibliographies, recipes, and writing prompts. And you can ask me anything. Although the class is aimed at creators of fiction, anyone is welcome to take it. The next class begins on Friday, September 17th. For all the details and to sign up, please visit medievalmasterclass.com. For everything from battles to bears, follow medievalist.net on Facebook or Twitter at medievalist. You can find me, Danielle Cebulski, all over social media at 5MIN Medievalist or 5-Minute Medievalist. And you can find my books at all your favorite online bookstores, where you can even pre-order the new one, How to Live Like a Monk, Medieval Wisdom for a Modern Life, which comes out in October. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Guy Frog. Thanks for listening, and have yourself an incredible day.